By subscribing to the 9 episodes of the Fallen Goddess scenario, you enter upon a great adventure. And like any adventure, it comes with certain challenges. There are unknowns to be met, and there are difficulties that arise along the way. Well, how could it be otherwise? Consider the claim that is attached to this narrative. It is the single coherent description of the origin of the human species and of the earth to be found in the entire record of mythology from all around the world in all ages. Granted, this story is cosmic in scope, truly astronomical. It is an astronomical myth. And it is complex in structure and detail. Nevertheless, the primary requirement to learn the myth, there are two, actually. The first requirement is simply the willingness to learn. The second requirement is love for the main character of the story. The Fallen Goddess scenario is, after all, the biography of this living planet. And it describes the life of the wisdom goddess who is embodied in the planet as it unfolded before she turned into the planet. That being so, it makes sense that the opening episodes of the narrative, in fact, all the way down to the 8th episode, describe events that unfold in the cosmic setting. Not just any cosmic setting, not just anywhere in the universe, but precisely in the cosmic setting of the third galactic arm of the vast lenticular spiral galaxy, which is our cosmic home. For those people in countless numbers who have learned this narrative and taken it to heart, it is compelling in its beauty above all else. And for those who love the story and want to become truly intimate and interactive with the wisdom goddess, well, every point in the story is instructive. There is so much to learn from this narrative, and that learning process is ongoing and ever enriching. Now, regarding the challenges that the myth may present to those who are coming to it for the first time, there are three considerations that might be helpful. First, the visualization of the story. Second, the attribution of human-like emotions and qualities and actions to the wisdom goddess, who is, be assured, not human. She is extra human. She is an aeon or celestial divinity of the galactic scale. And the third consideration concerns the relevance of the events that happen at the galactic level. Prior to that moment, unlike any other moment, when the star goddess turns into the earth, as described in episode 8. So here, proceeding as quickly as possible, is a rundown of those three considerations. First of all, reading the narrative silently, or perhaps reading the passages aloud, has the same effect as telling any story whatsoever. If you told the story of your vacation in the Greek islands, you wrote it down in a blog or related it verbally, the very act of doing so prompts the listener to picture what you're saying. It's natural. The human mind works that way. This is, of course, a great tale produced by the human imagination, and the human imagination can reach reality, can and does reach reality, probably in a more accurate and complete way than any other human faculty. And being such, it also invites the imagination of everyone who encounters it. So how would you picture it? How do you imagine it? Suppose, for instance, that you had the resources to make a film of this narrative. How would you do that? Well, it's pretty obvious that it would have to be a film that would appear in the genre of sci-fi fantasy. And it would have to be rendered through state-of-the-art CGI technology. Something like Avatar. It would have to be rendered in the very best possible CGI medium. As a matter of fact, suppose that you had been invited to a screening of a film, but you weren't told anything about the film. It so happens that the film is, in fact, a CGI animation of the narrative of the Aeon Sophia. But you're not told that. You're not given a clue. So you sit in the auditorium, and the film comes up, and naturally, you would be inclined to think that you're watching a sci-fi fantasy film. And in a way, you are. But in this case, the science fiction is true. The science fiction comes rendered in a mythopoetic medium. So obviously, that would be the medium for making a movie out of the fallen goddess scenario. In learning the story, you naturally picture the events. Now, there is one event in episode one that actually can't be pictured. Episode one is the prelude, you recall, when the originator releases a singularity which ripples across the universe like a pulsation, like a tremor. Once upon a tremor. Now the originator, who is at the source of all the aeons, cannot be represented in any way whatsoever. So possibly the film would open with something like a panorama of a vast black surface, as if you were looking down on the surface, flat, still surface of a vast ocean. And then the special effects might produce, say, something like a bubble coming up out of that ocean. And then the next image would be the galactic core with the bubble emerging in the galactic core to signify that it had been received by the aeons in that core. And from that point on, those aeons and the cosmic environment could be depicted lavishly and in a spectacular manner by state-of-the-art CGI. Of course, this begs the question, well, how would the Aeon Sophia herself be depicted? Certainly not in an anthropomorphic form, that is to say, certainly not in a human form, nor in any animal form. However, there is a convention of rendering these aeonic powers that can be found in ancient art and in ancient mythology, as well as in the shamanic traditions of many peoples. Probably, oh, certainly, the most common way that humans have pictured such beings is as snakes, as serpents. That doesn't mean that they would be necessarily compared to the serpentine creatures of the earth, and certainly not to the reptilian creatures of the earth. Although the image of celestial dragons is very common in Chinese mythology. No. What is a serpent? It is a creature that moves in a wave, that slides in a wave. So it is a good metaphor, if you will, for a current. The aeons are vast currents of plasmic luminosity, and these currents are alive. Everything in the universe is alive. They are filled with super life. There is life at the galactic level, and consciousness, and feeling, and choice, and desire. And so, the best possible option would be to represent the Aeon Sophia and the other aeons as a vast torrential serpent. And of course, you would have to put some kind of face on it, which would be a human or animal face, with two eyes and a mouth, and serpents as well have that kind of face. So picture an enormous, benevolent serpent, the snake woman. The snake woman is the most common and widespread epiphany or revelation of the mother goddess in all the cultures and mythologies of the world. So given that basic choice for representation of the main character in the story, the other aeons would likewise be represented in that way. So what you end up with is the galactic core is a teeming nest of serpents, which is exactly what it is. It's a teeming nest of massive, monumental currents of electricity and light, which is alive and conscious. The colors of snakes, of the serpent powers in the galactic core, are all basically white. If you go and you look at galaxies, you see that the core of them is a creamy white. But as they move and dance and interact, as they intertwine with each other, as Sophia and Thalete do in their dance to design the antipodes, they change colors. And so you would see in the film version beautiful hues of pink and rose and amber and green and mauve, dark hues, light hues, all soft colors, mingling and merging in the vortex of the galactic core. That would be how to represent it in cinematic terms. Then, of course, when the moment comes for Sophia to take her plunge, it would be represented by a plume of light, a massive plume of light, showing her snake-like body as it plunges out of the galactic core. The galactic core has a boundary and a membrane. It's like a cell, like an enormous cell on the galactic scale. You can compare the boundary of the Pleroma to the boundary of the yolk of an egg. It is porous, but it is also well-defined. In Sophia's audacious act of passion, she plunged through that membrane. And the momentum of her desire and of her forces directed toward the species that she had designed brought her all the way across the galactic limbs to that place where the species was embedded in the Orion Nebula. She wasn't just plunging out of the Pleroma to go on a jaunt in any direction whatsoever. She was heading for the object of her greatest passion. It's always helpful to bear in mind that Fallen Goddess Scenario describes events that actually happened in the galaxy, which could as well be described in purely non-narrative physical terms, in the terms of physics and astrophysics. It could be described in mathematical formulas. The scientists would assign a certain energetic potential to the galaxy. The core would have one potential. The arms would have a different potential. And other factors could be added to the physical description of the event, according to physics and astrophysics. The presence of gases can be represented by formulas. The operations of the Birkeland currents, and Sophia is a Birkeland current, could be represented. And all of that could be done because this was an event that actually happened physically and materially in the galaxy. But of course, that would not be a story. It would be a scientific paper with extensive mathematical notations. Now, having said that, representing the Ansophia in a serpentine body is the best choice for a cinematic rendering, the next consideration comes up. You notice immediately, as the episodes unfold, that these aeons have feelings. They have emotions. First of all, they are conscious and self-conscious. They communicate with each other. They observe. And they act. So they have willpower, cognition, emotion. And the question arises, well, hold on a minute. Is it really legitimate to attribute to these cosmic forces, these energy fields, the capacities for action and reaction, perception, emotion, and so forth, that are demonstrated by human beings and other animals as well? Is it really legitimate to do that? Or is that, it's called anthropomorphic interpretation, is that way of picturing the gods and attributing to them human traits valid? Or is it simply a fantasy, a projection that has no reality at its foundation? Good question. There are a couple of ways of tackling that question. First of all, simply by the assertion that unless they are represented in that way, unless they are described with these human and animal attributes, there is no way to describe the action of the story. There's no way to describe how they behave that is comprehensible to the human mind. And the fact that they are represented anthropomorphically cannot automatically be discarded as a mere projection. Why not? Because they are, in fact, alive, super alive. And being so, they must in some way exhibit the behavior of animals, of living creatures who are alive. They are great living creatures. They are great animals. The Aeon Sophia, embodied in the planet, is a great animal. The planet is an animal. As a matter of fact, up until the time of the Enlightenment, around 1650 in Europe, it was common in Europe, among the educated classes, and all around the world as well, to regard the planets as animals and the stars as well. So you only have to go back, not even 500 years, to a time when the mindset of the entire population of the earth regarded the universe animistically, that everything was alive. So that being so, it's not entirely wrong or inappropriate to depict these powers as having faculties like any other animals. They're just really, really big animals. And of course, there's a second objection that comes up. Well, how can they possibly, how can the Aeon Sophia, okay, I'll visualize her as a great winding serpent full of living luminosity. How can she see if she has no organs to see? How can she hear without ears? How can the aeons communicate with each other? They don't have mouths to talk. Well, they can use signals. They can signal to each other through sounds. A current makes a sound. A current can see. Currents of water, currents of air, currents of electricity, many such wave-like phenomena that you see in nature actually can be observed as having a kind of consciousness. They go in a certain direction. They know where they're going. So even though it may not be possible at first, perhaps later, to arrive at some clear idea of how the Aeon Sophia can see and touch and taste, it's fair to allow that she can do so in the course of learning the story. There's a striking detail coming from the field of science that could be regarded as verification of this view. Note that the word plasma, describing the energetic electrical fields in the universe, the Birkelin currents being a specific definition of these fields, is very close to the word plasm. And the fact is that when plasma was identified not too long ago in the 20th century, the scientists who observed it in the laboratory and then later observed it and detected it in outer space decided to call it plasma because their first observation showed them that it acts like plasm. And what is plasm? Well, it's the living substance in the human body. In your veins, you have blood with red cells, and you have plasm. So they named it plasma because it appeared to have the behavior of a living, animated force. Small detail there, but extremely revealing. Finally, coming to the consideration, how is all this detail in the galactic scenario, the first seven episodes, how is it relevant? Why does it matter? Why is it necessary? This is a really valid question. It's inevitable that anyone coming upon the narrative for the first time might have the impression being flooded with a lot of detailed information, which is really quite literally out of this world. So how can anything that happened to the wisdom goddess prior to the time when she turned into the earth and assumed the material body of a planet, how can any of that she experienced be relevant? How can it matter to the situation in the world today and to her situation? It might well be objected, well, what does it matter of all of these events that happened before Sophia turned into the earth and became Gaia Sophia? Why doesn't the fallen goddess scenario start at the moment that she appears in her planetary body and come forward from there? Why does it have to include all of these vast events that unfolded and transpired in remote reaches of time before the Earth even existed? Why? Now, this may sound strange, but no interpretation of the why, no explanation of why those cosmic episodes are relevant, can be adequate to satisfy the human mind. How so? The proof of the relevance of those episodes in the galactic arms comes in the power of the story itself. The story itself, as it unfolds, shows the relevance of all that came before. Naturally, encountering those episodes as a newcomer, it is not immediately clear how they would be in any way important or relevant to life on Earth today. As it turns out, they are all, and in every detail, extremely relevant and extremely revealing about the problems facing humanity in the world today. For instance, the problem of COVID-19. Bear in mind that FGS 1.5 brings the story down to the moment when Sophia turns into the Earth. Thus, it prepares the stage for the appearance of humanity on Earth. But those events occur in FGS 2.0, and they develop further in 3.0 and 4.0 down to 5.0. And 5.0 is current events, what is happening right now. So rather than seeking or presenting an explanation of why the cosmic episodes are relevant, it's better to rely on the story to show how they are. The story gains power as it comes forward in time to the present moment. The ongoing FGS after version 1.5 comes down into concrete details of history, the appearance of the various races, all the way down from ancient times to the present moment. And it's really in the present moment, facing what's happening in the world today, facing the plight of humanity, and the unparalleled threat that it faces. It's in the context of those events right here, right now, that you will come to see the relevance of that cosmic background, and especially the relevance of the Archons. The home story exposes the ultimate threat of the archons, as it operates across the entire planet today in the year 2020. The narrative reveals that the archons play a tremendous role in the biography of our Divine Mother. She created them, as shocking as it sounds to say that. That's what the myth tells you. She didn't do it intentionally. It was a side effect of her plunge. It was a mindless, energetic reaction. And yet the archons immediately present a kind of commotion that can only come from forces that don't really belong there in the first place. And they certainly don't belong here on Earth. Not to imply that they are on Earth in their exobiological forms, but their proxies, those who serve them, are most certainly on Earth. But that little detail is a bit premature. It would require another talk to go into the problem of the archons. And you can expect that talk to come at the conclusion of the 9 episodes.